today I am really pumped to be talking to somebody that I have been fascinated by ever since his book, The Anxious Generation, launched a few months ago, Jonathan Haidt. I'm so excited to talk to him as a parent, as somebody who is concerned about the amount of time we spend on our phones, especially the young generation. And I'm really looking forward to asking him all of my questions, all of my fellow mom friends' questions about how to go back to a play-based childhood and get our kids off of devices, especially smartphones. So get ready for an info-packed episode, and let's get right into it with Jonathan Haidt. Jonathan, this is like a really big deal interview for me as a parent, because all of my parenting friends are treating this interview for me as if I am interviewing like it's like a huge, huge god in our parenting space, which you are. So thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today. Your book, The Anxious Generation, to me was like a book that came out that was finally, to me, felt like a partner in my parenting journey so far. I have a 3.5-year-old and a 2-year-old and an 11.5-year-old stepson. So I'm fairly new in my parenting game, but your book to me and all of your posts that I constantly am reposting felt like, oh, finally, we're gonna be able to go back to how I grew up and how we were raised. Is that the reaction that you're seeing with parents?
Oh, yes. I mean, I certainly appreciate being referred to as a god coming down from on high. I love it. I don't think I've ever had such a nice introduction. But I think your reaction does explain why the book has caught fire in every country it comes out in. Like, mm-hmm. you know, I didn't even go to Spain, but it's on the bestseller list in Spain. And the reason is because all over the developed world, parenting has become a constant struggle over screen time. Like, we didn't ask for this. We don't want this to be the nature of our relationship with our kids, but it is everywhere. And a lot of the experts until now have been saying, well, you know, social media has some good sides, some bad sides, you know, talk with your child, you know, like, no. This is the most addictive technology ever. There are hundreds of psychologists on the other side of the screen trying to get at your child and trying to keep them. And so, yeah, parents are exhausted and fed up. So yes, your introduction, I think that is the way parents are feeling all over the world.
It's really amazing because I feel like this came at a time for me that was perfect because my kids are so young. But I feel like for parents that have gone through raising their kids in COVID, which I had my first child in COVID. So I missed the whole at home with technology, which caused so much damage to those generations. But what are you seeing from that kind of group of parents who parented through COVID and are looking at your book and they're just kind of wondering how to even backtrack?
So no, that's the right division. People with young children are so enthusiastic because it's like, wow, yes, I can avoid the fit. Like I see the conveyor belt. I see what's coming for my kids. And now if we work together, if I band with other parents, we can avoid that, give our kids a better childhood. The parents of kids who are in their late teens or early 20s have much more complicated emotional reactions. And some of them say they cried during parts of reading the book and to see what our kids went through and what happened to them. And they lament the mistakes they made. And my first message to them is, this was not your fault. This happened to parents all over the world. And when it started in the early 2010s, we all thought technology was great. You know, we thought, like your generation, I mean, you're a millennial, I believe. Mm-hmm. You know, millennials, you grew up with the early internet and it didn't harm you. The early internet was amazing. And things really changed once you get smartphones, social media, especially Instagram, front-facing camera, all these things that come in the early 2010s. That's when things began to get really toxic. But we didn't know. We didn't know for a long time. So what I say to them, and what I say in the book, is it's never too late. You can still change your kids' habits. Now, if they've left the house, obviously it's, you know, if they're 23, it's much harder. Yeah. But what I can tell you is, you know, I teach a course at New York University. One version of it is for sophomores, so 19-year-olds. The other version is for MBA students. We're about 28 typically, something like that. And we get amazing results. These kids, they're all addicted to their phones, almost all of them. The first thing they do when they open their eyes in the morning, they don't get a drink of water, they don't go to the bathroom. The first thing is they pick up their phone, they check their texts and incoming messages and social media. And then that's also the last thing they do in bed after they turn the light out. Before they close their eyes, last thing is this. And when we change their habits, when I work with them on protect your sleep, have a wind down routine, get the phones out of your bedroom, have a good morning routine, and also shut off almost all notifications. Do not let various people and companies interrupt you. You have very little attention to give and you've given all of it away. So if you want to be successful in life, you got to reclaim your attention first. Anyway, there's a lot more we could talk about, but my point is, even though I do think that some damage was done if your kid went through puberty on social media, it's not completely irreversible. People can make a lot of progress as young adults if they change their habits.
My mom is constantly sending my siblings and I not only interviews that you've done before your book came out and leading up to the launch of your book, but also just overall when you mentioned daily habits on things that you can change, like not starting your day looking at your phone or just small things that we don't even think about until they're brought to our attention with how much time we are on our devices and also just how much of it is a reflex of picking up your phone when you're bored or first thing in the morning or when you go to sleep at night. To go back to the launch of this book and the start of this book, was this something, I mean, you have so many amazing books. My husband is a huge fan of your book on the coddling of the American mind. He's like obsessed, talks about it all the time. And then when I showed him this book, he was like, of course, he's making another genius book. But what was the real cause to get you to put this book out and to title it the way that you did? Because I want to ask about the title.
Yeah, no, thank you. I mean, it was actually kind of an accident because my main area of research is moral and political psychology. And I wrote a book called The Righteous Mind, Why Good People Are Divided by Politics and Religion. That's my central academic research, which I did at the University of Virginia and again here at New York University. Because I studied moral psychology, I saw this weird new moral culture emerging on campus around 2014, 2015, when my friend Greg Lukianoff came to me and said, John, somehow students are learning to think in these distorted, depressed ways. It's making them miserable. You know, it's leading to the shout downs, the trigger warnings, all the hypersensitivity to words that students started showing in 2014. Now, at the time, we thought they were millennials. We didn't have the word Gen Z. I started working with Greg Lukianoff. We wrote an article called The Coddling of the American Mind. We then turned it into a book. And by then, we knew that the college students are not millennials. If you're born in 1996 or later, you're Gen Z. And you are different from the millennials because you went through puberty on smartphones and social media. And that, I think, is the major reason why they're different. So we wrote The Coddling. And then I thought, okay, now I'm going to go back to my day job. And I've got a book proposal and I got a contract to write a book called Life After Babel, Adapting to a World We May Never Again Share. And it's about what has social media done to our democracy. I mean, our country is insane. The things happening now were inconceivable 15 years ago, but now they're every day. So, a lot of that has to do with changes in the media, the virality, the craziness of social media, the performativity, all these, it's making us all crazy. So I thought, I have all this data on teen mental health. I've been tracking it for years now. Let me write chapter one, look what happened to teenagers when they moved their social life onto social media. And then the rest of the book is going to be about what happened to democracy when we moved our public square onto social media. We went insane. But once I wrote that first chapter and I started laying out all the graphs, and they almost all show hockey sticks. They almost all show there was no change, no real problem in the late 90s all the way through 2010, 2011. So when you were a teenager, there was no surge of mental illness. In fact, millennials are a little bit healthier mentally than Gen X before them. No sign of a problem all the way to 2011. And all of a sudden, 2012, 2013, anxiety, depression, self-harm, these things begin to skyrocket, not just here, but in all the English-speaking countries, in the Nordic countries, and a lot of Northern Europe. So once I realized, wait a second, this is not just like one chapter in a book on democracy. I've got to dig into this. I've got to figure this out. And I got to get this book out as fast as possible because we can't lose another year of kids. We've got to change course now.
I am so grateful that you did do that. I'm always interested when I talk about your book and also when I reshare your statistics or your interviews, which again, I feel like I have a, you know, a partner or a world that you've created that are like-minded people who are really excited about raising their kids less dependent on devices and of course, social media as well. Has there been a lot of or any pushback that you've experienced? Because I'll reshare a lot of your things or I'll even show your book or suggest your book to parents that are friends of mine or even my uncles who have kids that are, you know, late teens. And it's kind of like they're interested in it, but also their kids see the title of the book and the cover of the book. And they're like, is someone taking that away from me? Is someone... So it's a little bit of a, you want to share it all. And then also how do you do it in a way where parents aren't defensive?
Okay, good. So let's talk about the reaction to the book. It's been the most astonishing thing because all the previous stuff I've written has been somewhat controversial. It deals with politics. You know, one side likes it, the other side hates it.
Right.
This is an entirely different topic. This is entirely bipartisan. Republicans, Democrats, red states, blue states, we all have kids. We all see what's happening. There's massive support on both sides. The astonishing thing to me has been that there's been almost no pushback with one exception. There is a group of researchers, there are about 6 to 8 researchers who disagree with me and we're having a normal academic debate. They say, well, okay, you know, it's true that kids got on social media and right then is when mental health collapses, but it could be a coincidence. You can't prove it's causal. You can't prove that A caused B. Now, I think that's not true. I think I have proven it in that I've organized all the studies I can find. I don't cherry pick. I pick all the cherries. I take every study on all sides, the correlational studies, the experimental studies, the longitudinal studies, everything. If listeners go to anxiousgeneration.com/reviews, they can find all of the studies categorized in terms of what they show. So I think there actually is plenty of experimental evidence. But other than that, so that's a normal academic fight. I think I'm going to win it. I think I've got the evidence on my side to show it's not just a coincidence that happened all around the world at the same time. The move on into the virtual world is what caused this problem. Outside of those 6 to 8 researchers, there's been essentially zero pushback. I have not yet met a member of Gen Z who says I'm wrong. I seek out criticism because that makes me smarter. And I put a call out, you know, if you're Gen Z and you think we got this wrong, please say something. We can't find it because it's true that they're afraid someone's going to take their phone. But if you say, well, what if we took everybody's phone? Then they're like, oh, well, yeah, sign me up for that. Mm-hmm. Now, it's not the phone specifically necessarily, but social media, that's what you get. So when you say a study came out of University of Chicago last year, college students, how much would we have to pay you to give up Instagram for a month? And people say some number, you know, like $50, $100 or something. And then they say, well, what if we could get it? We're trying to do a study. We're trying to get everybody at your school to go off for a month. Now, how much would we have to pay you? And then the answer is negative $50. Like I would pay you. Like we all want this. Like we all hate being trapped. We all feel trapped on especially Instagram and TikTok. We see that it's wasting our lives. We see that it's feeding us garbage. We see that it's making us sick. It's giving girls eating disorders. We see all that. So Gen Z has been actually incredibly supportive. There's no, you know, and it's quite remarkable. There's no Gen Z movement to stop regulations, to stop the movement. They need help. They're asking for it.
What about the parents? That's where I feel the discomfort lies. Mm-hmm. Among my experience is I have a lot of friends who have toddlers, preschool kids, young elementary school kids who are so excited about this idea. And then there are also parents of kids that are older, that are 10 and up, who are less interested or less excited about the idea maybe, and more defensive of the fact that maybe they've leaned on an iPad or a device to be a babysitter for them for so long. And how are they going to backtrack that?
No, I think that's exactly right. There's a thing in psychology called solution aversion. If you don't like the solution, you then often deny that there's even a problem. And I'm not blaming these parents for doing that, but I acknowledge that beginning, you know, look, the iPhone came out in 2007. I got my first iPhone in 2008. My son was 2 years old at the time. And, you know, we let him play with it and he mastered it. I mean, he could figure out the swiping thing when he was 2. You know, you touch what you want. And I wish to God I had sold everything in my retirement accounts and put it in Apple stock on that day. I can't believe I didn't do that. But we all discovered, as soon as the iPhone came out, that you can have peace and quiet at the restaurant if you just give your kid your phone. Mm-hmm. You can do your email. You can cook dinner. You can do whatever you want to. Just give the kid what he wants, what she wants. More than candy, what they want is either an iPhone or an iPad. It's so exciting. It's so stimulating. So yeah, we relied on them as babysitters and we thought it was okay. But you know, I think 150 years ago, people gave morphine to kids. You give morphine, the kid's quiet. He stops crying, mm-hmm. you know, but you don't want to be giving your kids morphine every day. And that's unfortunately what we've done. Kids need to run around, have adventures. They need to master their bodies. They need to be outside. They need sunlight. They need nature. They need a lot of things to grow up healthy. And on the day you give your kid a smartphone or even an iPad, if it's theirs, you know, it's, I'm not saying you can never let your kid see a cartoon on an iPad. That's fine. Not in the first 2 years, but you know, that's okay. It's when you give your kid their own device, now it's theirs, and they can customize it, and they can have access to it for more than an hour a day. That's the day when the device is going to move to the center of your child's life, and it's going to be, from then on, not for all kids, but for most, it's this. The phone is in front of their face. While they're walking down the street, they're looking at the phone. While they're sitting at dinner with you, if you don't let them look at the phone, they're thinking about the phone. So the day you give them a device is the day that you lose them, in a sense. The phone will become the center of their life for the rest of their life until it becomes a chip implant where you don't need the physical phone. It just goes right in your brain. And I think we should probably establish the principle before we get to the chip implants. We should probably establish the principle that, you know what? A lot of technologies that are really helpful for us adults for doing our work, for getting the word out, they're really, really bad for children whose brains are still developing. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure if I answered your question there about the objection.
Yeah.
But yes, parents of young children are universally enthusiastic. Parents of teenagers are often more conflicted because they're afraid it's too late. But it's not too late. There's a lot you can do, especially if you team up with other families.
Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing is, you know, I'm the oldest in my family. I have a younger sister and two brothers. I always watched my two younger brothers play outside with their friends. And then when video games started, I look back on them now and they're so harmless with playing Mario Kart on a Nintendo. And that was only allowed when I was growing up in our house. It was only allowed when the sun went down and after you had done a full day outside.
That's fine.
And it's interesting now, I have a lot of friends that, you know, have kids that are 10 and up. And I talk to a lot of parents. And as I mentioned, I have a stepson. And a lot of these play dates that you, me being, I guess, naive and thinking that play dates are when you're going to go play outside. Right. These play dates are, do you want to have a play date and the kids can play video games? Mm-hmm. And there, it's fascinating to me that that would be something that I would be going out of my way to have kids do together, where they sit in front of a TV and play those video games and they're not going outside. But parents, when you talk about it, are like, yeah, that's of course ideal to have them be outside, and it's not convenient for that age group.
We're so afraid of sending them outside. You know, we don't trust our kids to not get hit by a car. We don't trust other drivers to not run over children. We're afraid that they'll be abducted, which just, you know, doesn't happen, but we're terrified of it. So I understand the fear of letting them outside. But let's talk about video games, because so much of the attention is on social media, and social media has a very direct relationship to all kinds of harms for girls: depression, anxiety, eating disorders, body dysmorphia, all kinds. Social media really does a number on girls. The evidence of it harming boys is not as clear. So let's talk about video games. The key idea in the book, in The Anxious Generation, is that for boys, the story is a little different. For boys, the story is we began overprotecting, we began blocking any sort of wrestling or physical play at school. We began not letting them outside. Boys especially need rough and tumble play. This is true across the animal kingdom or across mammals. Boys are more physical. Girls, when they get together, they want to talk. And social media lures them in and says, hey, talk on our platform. And so social media is a really effective trap for girls. It's not quite as interesting for boys. Boys want to do two things. They want to do war games, you know, team versus team sports. And they want to look at naked girls, at least for straight, you know, for boys who are heterosexual. Mm-hmm. And so used to be you had to work for both of those things. You had to go through some effort to set up a soccer game. you had to go through a lot of effort to find a girlfriend, to, you know, court, flirt, seduce, kiss. And now technology makes both of those effortless, instantaneous. You sit down, you turn on your device, you can find people to play with instantly from all over the world. You turn on your device, you go to Pornhub, you can find the most erotic images selected by algorithms and other men for the most, you know. So the argument in the book is that boys got systematically pulled out of the physical, real world where they must develop, where they must master skills, where they must toughen themselves, where they must turn into men. And we put them instead in front of screens where basically pornography and video games are incredibly addictive, and a lot of boys are getting addicted. It's not a majority, but you know, something around 10% of boys get addicted to some degree to video games and to pornography. And this is very damaging. If they're spending hours on it every day for years and years, this is going to interfere with their social and sexual development. So back to video games now. When I was a kid, you know, we watched a lot of television in the 70s, and our parents thought it was going to be bad for us. But the thing is, television is like the family hearth. Television is in the honored place. You sit there. There are usually other people around. Maybe it's your parents. Maybe it's your siblings. Maybe it's your friends. So you're watching TV together. You're talking about, you're laughing together. You're laughing at the same time to the same jokes. And then maybe you go get some food, or then maybe you go outside. So television, it turns out, was still actually pretty sociable. Whereas once kids have their own device, now sometimes, you know, my daughter will go over to a friend's house and they're just each on their separate. I mean, the other person is just on her device. Like, my daughter's like, why did I even come?
Yeah.
When each is on a separate screen, it's not social. Now, the video games, they were very primitive, you know, when I was a kid and when you were a kid. Now they're incredible. They're gorgeous. They're evolving. They've evolved so much. The high-speed internet allows you to play with people all over the world. So what's happened to boys? If you're a seventh grade boy or if even a fifth grade boy and you want to play with your friends, you can't go over to their house after school. If you do that, you can't play video games. You have to go home because you need your controller, your headset, your screen, and then you can play. And so when boys moved on to these multiplayer games, their time with their friends plummeted and they became very lonely. Our boys are so lonely.
It's wild to see the difference in how kids are interacting, what they're doing as far as, you know, when they do have a play date, what that looks like, girls and boys. I love a lot of what you say is, as parents, even as a parent of young children, can be daunting and overwhelming, but you always circle it back to the four new norms concepts, which I love as a parent of young children, because it gets me excited about these are things that we can do. For me right now, I'm in the phase where I'm looking at elementary schools. One of the things I always ask about is what their phone policies are. What are their tech policies? Majority of the schools that I look at, they have kids on iPads in a lot of classes. They have these big smart boards, which came right after I had left high school. So how do you as a parent look at these schools and sending your kids to school and see that there are classes that are on iPads starting in kindergarten?
Yeah, that's right. So the first thing about schools is that every school must go phone free. If a kid has their own personal phone in their pocket getting notifications, people are going to be texting and they will text during class. They're texting during class. They're watching porn during class. So people in your situation, you should make it clear that you will not send your child to a school that allows kids to keep their phones on them. That's just an absolute.
And that's separate. The phones are separate from
right.
an iPad.
That's right. So I just want to make clear first. Let's talk about the phones first.
Okay.
That's an absolute. Okay. Yeah. And in my book, I talked a lot about that. Now, then there's the question of, okay, you got rid of the phones. Now what? Well, you know, they all have iPads and Chromebooks. And I haven't done all the research on that, so I can't speak with as much authority about that. But what I've heard from teachers, what I've heard from what little research I've seen, is that there's essentially no evidence that any of these things help. They were brought in because they looked cool. We assumed computers are good. They're provided by the companies, the tech companies, by Apple and Google. That what little research shows benefits is done by the companies, and research that's not done by the companies doesn't show a benefit. And what you have to really keep in mind is, even if there's a theoretical benefit, the distraction effects are so massive. If you have anything that has multiple apps on it, you know, imagine, you know, when you and I were in high school, well, yours, you know, way after me, but in the 70s or 80s, 90s, if they said, you can bring in your television set, you can bring in your record player, your walkie-talkies, a paint-by-numbers kit, bring everything in, put it on your desk, use it during class. Oh, and, you know, we also want you to do your schoolwork. So I think these things are massive distraction devices. Now, as for the teacher having access to the internet and the smart board, I think that probably is good. But the thing is, it's the personal technology. And the way, one reason that we can be pretty confident that this stuff is terrible is that the people who make it don't let their kids have it, and they send their kids to schools that don't allow it. So Steve Jobs famously would not let his children have an iPad because he knew what it would do. He knew how it's going to grab them and never let go. A lot of tech people send their kids to the Waldorf School out in Silicon Valley, mm-hmm. but it's around the country, but the Waldorf School, which has no technology. Yes, there's a computer room, so the kids are going to learn how to use a computer, but in the classroom, you don't have massive distraction devices. They use pen and paper, there's a teacher, they talk, they're present. And we also have admissions from the people who design the stuff. I mean, they themselves say, yeah, we were trying to figure out how to maximize the quick dopamine hit. If you get quick dopamine, it's more addictive. We want to give them, you know, the pulses of pleasure to keep them on. So it's tragic that we let our schools be taken over by these addictive technologies with no evidence that they're helping. And a lot of evidence, apparently, certainly the way it looks, is that they're just so distracting that they're interfering with learning.
Yeah, I mean, not only that, but I think, you know, it's also when you position it in the way that you speak about it as the thing that is really getting in the way of this being stopped are the parents not being on the same page.
That's
and
right.
The idea of parents all being on the same page is so great. And when you have friends who are like-minded, of course, that seems like it's feasible. And then when you think about going to a bigger school where there are more parents, I love the idea of all being on the same page and having this belief that you talk about in your book and also on social media and in everything that you do. But is there a way that you suggest parents talking about that subject mm-hmm. to get other parents as a group on the same page?
Yes, absolutely. So this is the key, is that we work together. The central idea of the book is that we're stuck in these collective action problems where if you're the only parent who doesn't give your fifth grader a phone, your fifth grader says, Mom, I'm the only one. I'm isolated. I'm alone. That, you know, I don't know what's going on. And that puts pressure on you and on everyone. And so I'll just list the four norms, then I'll talk about how to talk about them. So the four norms that will solve the collective action problem are no smartphone before high school. Just give them a flip phone or a phone watch earlier. No social media before 16. Social media is insane as a way for the world to get to your child, for pornography, beheading videos, animal cruelty videos. I mean, horrible stuff. Can't we at least like just wait till 16? Like as a minimum, I'm not saying it's safe at 16. I'm saying let's have a norm. None of us are going to let our kids get on Instagram or TikTok until 16 minimum, Snapchat too. Third norm is phone-free schools, which we've already talked about. And the fourth norm is far more independence, free play, and responsibility in the real world, because we can't just take away the devices. We have to give kids back a fun childhood, an exciting childhood. And the more you think about it, not as, you know, Billy, I'm taking everything away. The more you think about it as, Billy, I want you to have the kind of fun childhood that I had or that your grandparents had or that people always had. And I've been talking with the parents of your four best friends and we're all on the same page. We all want you to have fun. We want you to have adventures. We want you to have fun together. So we're all implementing these policies. We're all saying no video games, you know, no video games except on weekends, you know, 2 hours a day on weekends. You guys can coordinate. Or something like that. Some restriction. You don't want it to be every day. But, you know, we're all doing the same thing. So you're not going to be cut off. You and your friends are going to have some video game time on weekends. And we're encouraging you to hang out at each other's houses. And if it's possible for you to walk or bicycle between them, just go. Even if you're, you know, 9 years old, you know, nine-year-olds can walk for miles. I mean, mm-hmm. it used to be at age 6 or 7, kids would walk to school. Now we're so afraid we don't let them walk till they're 10 or 11 or 12. Mm-hmm. So anyway, the point is, don't try to do it on your own. I mean, you can if you're really strong, but it's hard. Talk to the parents of your kids' friends. You're probably already on a WhatsApp group or a text thread. Coordinate with them. Odds are they've heard of the book. They've heard of this movement. They're thinking the same as you. We all have the same fears about what's happening. So if you coordinate with your friends, then you can do these norms. And it's not just easier. It's actually fun. You're going to see your kids laughing together more. You're going to see them having adventures. Sometimes they'll go out as a group and there will be an argument and there'll be tension and there's no adult around to adjudicate it. They have to figure it out for themselves, and they will. So yeah, that's the trick. Coordinate with other parents and follow the same norms.
And is that something to start when your kids are in preschool, or is this something to start at a certain grade in elementary school?
Well, the coordinating with other parents doesn't matter when your kid's, you know, 3 or 4, because they're focused on you and the home environment. But once they're in elementary school and they start having friends, you want to encourage play dates. And it's very important that play dates be phone free and screen free. Just make it very clear. If you have a 7-year-old and there's another kid coming over to play, make it clear to the other parent that, you know, we don't allow individual screen, you know, individual devices in the house. If your kid has a phone, and actually in second grade, a lot of them do. If your kid has a phone, we're just going to ask you to hold it. We're going to put it in a box. We want the kids to play together. Always make it about possibility, not about deprivation. So I think by the time your kids have friends, you do need to be coordinating with the other parents. And I believe, because everything's changing this year, parents are so excited about that. Because we were all so despairing. We were all so hopeless. We all felt like, well, you know, what are you going to do? This is the way things are. You know, we have to meet kids where they are. And no, we don't. We don't have to meet kids where they are. If the kids are playing on the railroad tracks, I'm not going to meet the kids where they are and say, well, there are pluses and minuses of playing on the railroad tracks. Like, no, there are not. Just get off the railroad tracks and then we'll talk.
Yeah. It's such an important question. I think also one of the 4 norms where you say phone-free schools, I loved the part that you said, which is not phone-free schools that people think about of keep it in your backpack, keep it in your pocket, you can't be on it during class, but really not having them be a part of their walking around on campus, having it as a phone check-in where you drop your phone or don't bring it to school at all, right?
That's right. That's really crucial, because it turns out the great majority of schools will tell you that they ban phones. The great majority of schools have a policy, which is you're not allowed to use your phone during class unless the teacher tells you, which means you're not allowed to use it openly. You have to hide it. My kids are very good. They learned in New York City public schools. They learned how to hide the phone, either behind their desk or in a book. So that's the rule. You have to hide the phone use, and then you can use your phone. That's what the great majority of American schools are doing. And that's a complete disaster. So some of them use phone caddies. You know, okay, you come in, you put your phone, there's like, it looks like a shoe rack sort of thing, or a little, you know, you put your phone in at the start of class, and on your way out, you get your phone. This is a terrible policy. It takes 10 or 20 minutes. If the kid is immersed in social media drama in the 5 minutes between classes, they put their phone in the phone caddy. Now you have an addict in withdrawal who is thinking about what's going on in social media. And it takes a variable amount of time, so at least 20 minutes before they can sort of maybe forget about that and tune into class. But class is only 40 minutes long. And then as soon as class ends, they rush for their phones. And in between classes, it's silent. This is the thing, when schools go phone free, one of the things they always say is, we hear laughter again between classes. We hear laughter at lunch. The kids are talking to each other. Because if you don't ban the phone for the full day, if you let them have it between classes or at lunch, they're on their phones during classes, between classes and at lunch.
Mm-hmm. I know we're getting towards the end of this interview. I want to ask to wrap. Parents that are, and even if you're not a parent, just people that are have become dependent on smartphone, walking around with a smartphone. As parents, I remember getting to a point, you know, kids are smart and you say, well, why are you doing that? Why am I not allowed to do that if you're allowed to do that? And, you know, you get into conversations. And how important is it as parents to also implement a lot of the things that you're talking about in your book when we're talking about younger generations, but as parents, we also want to be practicing what we preach in front of our children and implementing boundaries. I, for one, would love if somebody said to me, I don't want to hear an email or a text after this time, or, you know, starting to put boundaries. How important is that as parents to be also on the same page?
So it's a two-part answer. If you have an infant or a young toddler, it's very important to pay attention, because, you know, the baby comes out and the eye contact is so important, and the reciprocal interactions, it's so thrilling when it gets to the point where, you know, you tickle them and they laugh, and then you pretend to tickle them and they laugh anyway. And like, you know, those sort of, you know, the give and take sort of games. And what we have is a nation, a world, in which parents are doing what's called continuous partial attention, which is, yeah, I'm interacting with you, but I'm, you know, look, I'm also on the phone. Oh, yes, that's a hippopotamus. Yes, and you're back to your phone. This is really bad. They need the direct social interaction, the give and take. So for young children, I think it is very important. You don't have to spend all day with them, but when you're with them, you want to really be present and have the eye contact and not the distraction. Now, once your kid is a teenager, you know, I get your question a lot, you know, from parents who think, well, you know, of course my kid's going to copy me. Really? Your kid's going to copy, your teenager is going to copy you? Mm-hmm. I mean, if I start reading The Economist magazine, my daughter, my 14-year-old daughter is going to say, oh, I want to read The Economist. Hell no. She doesn't care what I do. Right. She is entirely focused on what the other kids, or the other girls in her group, she's a freshman in high school. She's entirely focused on what they think and what they're doing. And I've told her she can't have Snapchat, and she understands, but she hates that. She feels isolated. You know, I made the decision. I'm glad I did. My college students tell me, yep, that's the right decision. Snapchat has some good things about it, but has a lot of bad things about it too. Mm. So my point is, if your kids are older, yeah, you should clean up your habits, but it's not because it's going to convince your kids to change. They're not. You probably want to clean up your habits. In fact, chapter 8 of the book is actually about what this is doing to adults, how this is spiritually degrading us. It is making us more judgmental, more scattered, less present. All the things that the ancients tell us to do, a life spent online pushes us to do the opposite. So for your own happiness and sanity, get hold of your habits. But I don't think it's going to make a huge difference to your kids. That's why I think the key thing is delay. Once you give them a phone, and now you're in negotiations, and now you're trying to put on limits, and now once you give them a phone, you're going to be in this fight for the rest of their time with you. So delay the fight. And if we can all delay it, we can all delay it. How about no smartphone till 14? How about no social media till 16? Let's at least delay it until they're partway through puberty. People must protect early puberty, especially.
What was it that you called it? Partial what?
Continuous partial attention.
I love that. And I think you see it so much now, continuous partial attention. When I take my kids to playgrounds, when you go on walks, I remember learning about the gaze when I was pregnant with my first daughter and the importance of that eye-to-eye contact, that interaction, whether you're breastfeeding or you have them in a stroller, not having your phone be a part of it.
That's right.
And the importance with developing attachment at such an early age. So I love that takeaway as a parent of toddlers and also trying to navigate what those boundaries are, wanting the boundaries, but also trying to figure out how do you implement them? And
that's right. So I know we're getting near the end of time, but I'd love to make some specific suggestions, especially for people for parents of kids in K through eight. So I was really, really influenced by a woman named Lenore Skenazy, who wrote the book Free Range Kids. She became a friend of mine in New York. Because I read that book, that I gave my kids a lot more independence in New York City. My wife and I trusted our kids to walk 3 blocks to the store, to walk to school. We gave them a much more free-range childhood because of her. Lenora and I co-founded an organization called Let Grow. I would urge parents, especially if they're younger than eighth grade, go to letgrow.org. We have all kinds of ideas for things you can do at home, things you can do in your school to give your kids more independence. Because again, this can't just be about taking away the phones. This has to be about giving your kids an exciting, fun, educational, adventurous childhood. So letgrow.org. Also, please, I hope listeners will go to anxiousgeneration.com. That's the website for my book. And actually, Lenore helped me write some of the chapters in the book, the specific advice for parents. Anxiousgeneration.com, go to Take Action. We have all kinds of advice, all kinds of specific things you can do at home, the Let Grow Project, ways of giving your kid a lot more independence. So anxiousgeneration.com, we have a lot of advice for parents, for teachers, for educators. My main opponent since I've been working on this issue, my main opponent has been resignation. That parents feel like it's just overwhelming. And I've tried and I can't do it. I can't do the constant fighting. But I am wildly optimistic that we're actually going to succeed because we're all in the same boat. And if we just realize that and we work together and you talk with the other parents you know and you agree to have similar policies, we can change childhood within 2 years. Not that every kid's going to be off, but our common assumptions now about what childhood is, that they're only since 2010, childhood was not like this before 2010. But this 2010 to 2024 period, this disastrous period, when we took away childhood, we can give it back. It's not too late.
Mm-hmm. I love that. I think that's so encouraging. And with all that you do, you always offer tips and really approachable information that makes it less daunting for parents and allows them to really put things into action. And that's, to me, why I think your book is so incredibly successful with parents of all age kids, is because there are things that are so clear. Like, you can't deny, where do I start? What do I do? How do I do it? You list them out so clearly and in such a great way. So thank you so much for writing this book, The Anxious Generation. I'm such a huge fan of yours and all the work and things that you put out into the world to help us parents, but also to help the world overall. And I'm so grateful you took the time to chat today. I know you're so busy, and this is such an important thing to talk about in all areas. And I'm so grateful. So thank you.
Well, thank you, Catherine. Thanks for giving me the time. Thanks for helping me reach your audience. And yeah, we're all in this together. Let's fix this together.
Yes. Amen. I love it. Thank you. Thank you so much to Jonathan Haidt for such an informative and also really encouraging conversation that we have today. I feel like it's all going to come down to us parents getting together and being on the same page to allow our kids to have a more play-based childhood, which is how we all grew up, and get them off of the screens, get them off of the smartphones, have boundaries. That all starts with us coming together and being on the same page. So if you haven't already read it, The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt, such an informative and awesome book, whether you're a parent or not, just learning about all of the craziness of smartphones and technology. So thanks for joining.